somebody in just, like Emma Lou Fain, in just an hour and a half. I mean, it could go on and on. The journalist in me wants to ask the basic questions: who, what, where, when, why, and how. But that poses a problem. For example, the who. Which Emma Lou Fain am I interviewing? Is it the Emma Lou Fain who's the prolific, respected writer, author of 11 books of poetry, nonfiction, and fiction, and co-author of another book with her daughter, Becky Thane Markosian? Or is it the Emma Lou Fain who's the popular public speaker, whose diverse audiences range from Mormons' women's conferences across the country to the nuclear disarmament test ban treaty congress in the Soviet Union that drew 300 delegates from 23 countries? Is it Emma Lou Fain, the exemplary mother of five daughters, some of whom are expected here a little later today, along with their father Mel, who is here, and Emma Lou's husband, 17 grandmother to 17 grandchildren, one on the way? Or is it Emma Lou, the effective communicator and healer, whose spirit of love and acceptance and what I call her cockeyed optimism has fostered the cause of peace and understanding among communities whose diversities range from religion to lifestyles? Or is it Emma Lou, the athlete, the tennis champion who still, at age, we'll let her tell you how old, says she'd rather hit a ball than almost anything? Or is it Emma Lou, the reservoir of spiritual sustenance for so many of us through her conversations, talks, and writings, not the least of which is the words to the hymn, "Where Can I Turn for Peace," whose message continues to uplift us? Or is it Emma Lou, the friend and comrade in arms to so many? Even walking through the mall with Emma Lou is an adventure. She knows so many people, and she's got to stop and have a good talk with each one. She may not remember their names, which, as far as I can see, is one of her very few weaknesses, but she knows the people. The list of all the different Emma Lou's could go on. All this diversity in just this little short body, and as you noticed, we were experimenting with several formats here, all because she wants to be up where she can see you. And she's gone through life from about a five-foot perspective and likes to be up above things. Now, that's just the who's. The list could go on. Now, that doesn't even get into the other questions, intriguing as they are, particularly the whys. So in the interest of time, I think I'll narrow my questions to a few specific areas to encompass the theme you see in your program: peace poems and a woman's place. And then I know nothing's more frustrating than to be sitting in the audience and have the person asking the questions never ask the one question you want answered. So we'll save some time at the end for you to ask the questions that you'd like to. So first of all, Emma Lou, why don't you come up here and get ready for your first question? So I'm just going to ask you a general question about your writing. Why do you write? When did you start writing? What compels you and inspires you? And why do you write about what you write about?
I don't get to talk to you, huh? You're sitting down behind?
No.
Okay. Why do I write? It's like asking, why do I breathe? It's so basic to everything that I feel in a day that I sometimes feel as though I don't even know why or what I'm thinking until it's on the page. And then it sort of appears like invisible ink. I am surprised often at what I am thinking or feeling and as it appears. I think this has been a disease for me ever since I can remember. When I was a little girl, I was writing, like in fourth grade, I can remember Miss Peterson read some poems that we had written as her students. And I can remember that she read mine, and I wish I could remember it like my names. I don't remember my lines very well, but it was something about mixing batter that spilled on the blue kitchen floor. And, of course, it had the da-da-da rhythm and rhyme. And when she got through, and there'd been a girl that read one just before, and I knew that it came from the Campbell Kiddies. Does anybody here old enough to remember the Campbell Kiddies and the Saturday Evening Post? And I had read that. I read those all the time. I really liked them. But I remembered that I'd read that. And she read hers, and it was fine. And then I remember Miss Peterson. I haven't thought about this in a lot of years. And Miss Peterson looked at mine and she said, "Oh, this one's been copied from somewhere." And I felt so terrible. I thought, "Oh, Miss Peterson, I didn't copy it." But then I talked to her after and tried to explain that this was something that had happened to me very clearly. But that was maybe the beginning of it. I can remember a number of years later, that there used to be missionary farewells that had programs on Friday nights. Does anybody remember this? They'd have a big program and then a dance, and I kind of got on the circuit. Oh, I remember along the way before that, my mother had me reciting poems. One was Polly's Dollies and Caught Susanna Whistling Well, It's Almost Nigh Too Good to Tell. T'would have been too good to... Anyhow, it was fun. Polly's Dollies, Polly had five dollies once. And I've kind of thought about this with my five daughters. And Polly had, with Luli had five daughters once, but that was long ago. I'll tell you all about them. Shell? Sorry, this is a day that's crazy. Our youngest daughter is moving away, and we've been helping them pack, and it's that old double-edged kind of thing that literature of any kind always deals with, the trade-offs. I mean, we could not be happier for them. He has a job teaching, which down at UTEP in El Paso, Texas, and it's everything that he's trained for and will love doing, and they'll take their two little boys and have a wonderful life. But for us, well, you know the story. Anyhow, I can remember writing a poem at the... Oh, dear me. I'm not usually so... Anyhow, when Shelley back there got married, who's now tonight in charge of her 20th reunion at East High School, and I can remember the last lines of that. Thank you very much. The last lines of that were something about as I vacuum up the blanks after eating the white frosted cake, I vacuum up the blanks and wonder where they go. And the blanks occur, and I suppose it's those blanks that I've both enjoyed and been tearful over, because we move through our various stages, and in every case, whatever stage we move into becomes one that we're delighted to occupy. I would not go back a syllable. And writing has provided me along the way with a great means of expressing what I'm feeling. I never lose track of the privilege of being invited to speak or to have a readership who want to read what I have to think about an idea or a situation or a person or a cause. What could be more satisfying than to be able to bring up the thing that is at that moment critically important in one way or another? I'm going on too long, Dan. You need to ask another question. But writing also, in addition to this, and it has been part of me forever, from assemblies at East High School, Shelley, to through the university and being Toastmistress everywhere I went, and then being... Poet Laureate for the PTA and the MIA and wherever I was, and it's been so much fun. But beyond that, writing has exposed me to so many marvelously interesting people and places that I never would have been privy to in any other way, because I've met people across the country, across the world, who share that compulsion to write, and whom I've been able to study under to learn how to do it better, and then to be connected with other people who are doing this in ways that have so fortified me and given me a glimpse of the world that I never could have had I not had the lucky thing of having that pen in hand or that keyboard under my fingers. Well, that was a long answer.
That's good. That's what I want. Then I don't have to come up with very many questions. Talk a little bit about the themes of your writing, and then I know it's like asking you to choose among your children, but is there anything that you've written that's been particularly satisfying in its in any way?
My themes, I guess, have dwelt pretty much or dealt pretty much with whatever was going on at the moment. For years and years, I was writing, of course, about my family, and I was publishing some in those years. I won a short story contest here and there and a poetry something here and there, but mostly I was writing on paper napkins or ironing boards or something because I was busy, so busy with five little children under 10. But the themes then became part of maybe the first collection I put together, which was about mothering, and it was called The Making of the Difference. And I entered that. I remember a friend typed it up for me because I didn't have time to get final copy. And always I'd make a mistake in the last line and just, ooh, I love my word processor. Is it wonderful? You don't have to worry about that. But I entered this in the Utah Poetry Society way back in, 1965, four, something like that. And it was all about mothering and being at home and being part of the family and whatever was going on. And I remember that I was extremely disappointed because I not only didn't win anything, but I had someone say that my line breaks were completely inconceivable. And so then I began writing in a little more depth when I went back, when our youngest girl started school, I went back and got a master's in creative writing. And I studied with Henry Taylor, and it changed everything for me. Because he was a mentor of mentors, and he saw everything I wrote. He was a visiting poet here from Virginia, and only here 2 years. And he saw, like I say, everything I wrote, and he would get me for my sentimentality. He said, especially when I wrote about my family, that I needed to tie it all with a pink bow and make sure everybody understood it. And he described it as a way I'll never forget. He said, it's like doing a breaststroke through a bucket of honey. It was so sweet and sentimental. So he'd often cut off my last stanza, but he hardened me up and he taught me lots of things. And he won the Pulitzer about 5 years ago. And I think back on what he did for me and what he did, how he changed my life. My first published book of poems was my thesis, which was called Spaces in the Sage. And this was in many forms, which he had us practicing in his classes. And it's like, I'm sure, with a painter learning to paint traditionally and realistically and representationally and then branching off into other things. Then my themes became all kinds of things from there on. Everything that was happening in every direction, and I became interested in and writing about, and moved into areas where I was writing about peace, which intrigued me a whole lot. And Deanne asks, which might be my sort of favorite work. It couldn't be a favorite work, but maybe the poems that I wrote in 1983 that I called my peace poems, I was asked to write, or I was asked to read on a program of Kinship Among Nations. And I wrote a suite of poems in response to something that I read in Time magazine, where Catholic bishops had asked their people to consider the things that they'd considered in coming out with a very strong stand against nuclear war and nuclear arming. So I wrote this. It was called How Much for the Earth, and it's six considerations. And I guess these are the poems that have gone farther than anything I've ever written, because they were later translated into Russian and German, and they were published in the Soviet Union in Kiev before it became a separate entity. And it was a passport for me to take to the Soviet Union, the translation of these poems. Got me through customs into churches, had me visiting with people I never would have had any connection with. So I suppose those were as important as anything that I've written. And then at this Congress that Deanne talked about, They were important there. So that theme became a primary thing. Through everything, there's been the theme of what is it to be a woman? Does it make any difference that I'm a Mormon woman living in Salt Lake City in a pretty cloistered existence? Am I any different, really, from the woman that I might meet in Romania in the Cemetery of Heroes and feel instant connection with? Am I any different from the women that I see all across the country at women's conferences, both for church and otherwise? Am I really any different as a woman standing in front of Rotary who've asked me, please come and tell us what women are about? That was an interesting occasion. But am I different, really, from any of these women? And do I write primarily as a woman? I don't even do that. I write as somebody involved with the human condition, I think. Because I was brought up in a family of boys. I did what my brothers did. I was a tomboy little girl. I had a wonderful double-edged life because, again, I loved to play with my dolls. And I dreamed of when I could have a baby of my own. And at the same time, I'd go out and climb trees and chin myself with my brothers and learn to throw balls and love hitting a ball. All of that was there. And so through the years, whatever my themes have been, they've erupted out of whatever was going on. And because there's so much going on all the time, I've been able to write about a lot of different kinds of things. So does that tell you?
Let's talk just a little bit about the creative process. I've heard you say the night is your greatest resource. What does that mean, and how do you go about tapping into your creativity, and what is your creative process in writing?
The night is my friend, my really willing friend that accompanies me into a sleep that is never unproductive. And when I was, I remember in school, I would make notes and try to condense everything to one page, and then I'd go to sleep rather than study. And I'd wake up in the morning and I had my answers. And so I've learned over the years, and this has nearly scared my husband to death, but when I'm looking for something and I'm not quite finding it, or even if I think maybe I could find it, the best thing I have, the best ally I have is to go to is sleep. So I go to sleep, and I wake up, and I have to get hold of a notebook and pen immediately to write down what has been fed to me in the night. And I'm to the point now where I just trust it so much that I just go to sleep and wake up with whatever I need. This is my most helpful creative process. It may sound kind of crazy, but it works. And it feeds me every single time. I wrote a poem I remember about that riding the train in the Soviet Union in 1984. We went from Moscow to Irkutsk, Siberia, which is five time zones across that vast country, to Lake Baikal. And there we were in the train, and you'd think it'd get claustrophobic. We had 4.5 days and nights on that train, and we never were off for more than 15 or 20 minutes. To run around and hurry back on because it would just slither off without us if we didn't. But I can remember getting that feeling of having being almost like a nest doll. In fact, I wrote about this, where, you know, the Russian nest dolls, that the outside was the outside that we were passing through and seeing that gorgeous Siberia in June. It was absolutely beautiful, broke every stereotype. But then moving through the train, then there'd be the compartment that we were in. And there were 36 of us on this compartment. In the train, with each of us with four to a compartment. And then I had a top berth, and that would be my next one. And I'd get up onto there and be by myself, where I could write in my journal or read or do something apart from everybody else. And then I'd find myself just going inside myself. And then finally, I'd get into that place. Where it is the most comfortable kind of meditation that can take place. Where I was there, and that I felt that's where I found the Holy Ghost and God, and everything that I intended in my life would come there. to be part of it. So maybe that describes that creative thing as much as I can. I'm working on a book now that's called The Mystic Life that has to deal with this, because I have found that I am writing poems called Midnight and the Disappearance of Words, where words are gone, and it's all this kind of connectedness with other things that are so informing and so warming and comforting and holding. Maybe should I mention that 7 years ago I had an accident on a freeway where my son-in-law was driving, and a big piece of metal weighed about 6 pounds came through the windshield and hit me in the face. And he had figured it up. He's a surgeon, but he figured in terms of physics that it was something like how many joules is the way they figured it. But at any rate, the force of that thing was so severe, and it went back and lodged in the back window, and there was really no way that I could have survived this kind of accident. But I did, and I had a death experience in the process, which also informed me in the subsequent months when I couldn't read or put my head down or do the usual kinds of things. And I learned to listen to this inner music that was so real and so part of everything that I was doing that I've leaned on it ever since, and found that it is the thing that lets me be, and that gives me that sense of it's all right. Everything is going to be all right in its time. So that's a big part of my creative process at this point. Do you want to mention about any? Ask your next.
Why don't you go on with that if you'd like to?
No.
Well, I was going to ask. Your typical day seems so full of activities and people, and you're talking about the need for the mystic part of you, the quiet part. How do you find this balance between all the people, all the activities, and this need for the solitude that brings the mystical to you?
It's a trick. It's really hard, because I've tried to explain to some of my writing friends who aren't in Mormondom, they say, what do? Your children are all grown, they're all gone. What in the world do you do? And I try to say, well, and what I've concluded is really that I do people, and people do me. I love it. I love people and what they do offer and how exciting it is to be part of that. But I do need the other, as I think most of us do, and I've learned that I have to have it in order really to feel ungrainy. Sometimes I can feel really barnacled by all of the activities. So I have to go away, and I do this by... I have a studio that's 7 minutes but eons away from home that hasn't a phone. I learned this from painters in an artist colony. I don't try to work at home. I have a study there where I do business, but I go away to try to do any writing. Have my computer there. And then when I really have a big project, I have some wonderful friends in Sun Valley who invite me to use an empty condo in the off seasons, and I go all by myself. And until I had learned this, I had never known what it was to be absolutely quiet in my inner self. And the last poem that I wrote there, the first time that I was away for something like 28 days, which was a miracle, I'd never been away like that. My poem was Nirvana, which I think talked about what can happen when you get to wake up one nerve at a time. Okay. This is in this Things Happen, Poems of Survival, that came out about 2 years ago. Let's see. This is a kind of meditation. You'll probably all go to sleep. Are you ready? Nirvana, last morning of a time away. I've never read this aloud before. 22 days alone have done it. Nights and mornings blending like fog and sky. Sometimes it takes that to learn how it is when you get to wake up one nerve at a time. First, you prepare for sleep. Tired, but not too, and slowly. Ablutions, nothing, and the gentle eruptions in your head. A line from a poem, a place in a story, a collecting of ideas who have yet to meet, the face of your grandmother, the hand of your love, your child at different ages, your sense of forever. You're ready for bed without knowing, everything in for speculation. Formalities take shape, kneeling, sitting, lowering to a pillow, nothing yet touching off edges and ends, trying to let go of themselves. Perhaps you will read them to rest. You will know when it's time. You will reach for the light, barely sink from it, to remember your scalp, how it likes to draw back on its goods, free its face to feel, the pillow, the cheek, the temple, the jaw, the ear, flush with the down, the case. That is all. Then it is morning. Probably not late. No sound has found you. Only dreams not wanting to be lost. An eye might flicker toward the window for a time. No matter. The lid is unwilling to part for long with what is behind it. The generous grantor of wisps waiting for form. Liberators, informants, characters of a language never inconceivable. You cohabit the space that is nowhere. Drafts and injections spill within you. You are empty and full, by now weightless. Enjoy the luxury of levitation. Nothing is separate. No wrist or hip has ligament, muscle. Examine the comfort of everything. Come into place. Tongue to mouth, palate, teeth, surfaces having found each other, legs, sheets, bottom, the outside of your ribs, arms, shoulder, what they lie on. Your feet are conscious of their soles, your eyes aware of being covered, affronted if not. Adopt the covering, the remaining, your heart containing itself going nowhere, then ticking to attention in your palms. Breathing exists on its own, a bellows on automatic, slow, deep. It's not yet time for a thought. Acquainting is still elsewhere. Impressions come like invisible ink, by formulas that refuse formulation. Your other outer boundaries sift into everywhere. You are taken, as if giving in to great weariness. You are rested awake. This is the home of the muse, of the holiest of ghosts. You wait here longer, accepting, honoring, until you are given the time to return. Gravity and willingness have looked out for you. Resistance must come as the gentle inflating of a balloon, one breath at a time. You pay attention. Under the soft ringing, you can hear your heart, first in your ears, then in your throat, finally in itself, rhythmic, delicate, sound, promising. Gradually, your light moves outside of you. Dimly, then, you admit sounds, stirrings of systems inside, out, viscera, brain, furnace, plumbing, a breeze, a bird. Fingers, toes start to work themselves. Slowly, joints unflop. You acquiesce, fold like a rag doll out of yourself, strung only to where you have been. Your neck is your pulley, up, out. You take shape. You blink at what has been waiting and step toward the day in peace, prepared by what passes understanding. You will save this morning for protection against days when you will be jarred awake, not knowing who has been to visit in the night. That's a
Emma Lou, as you've expressed, the spiritual elements seem to be a part of everything that you do. Can you talk a little bit about the wellsprings of your spirituality? When do you first remember a sense of believing, and where does your belief spring from?
I can't remember a beginning to believing. It's always been there. I can't remember ever really doubting the basic fundamental belief in God and a life hereafter and the presence of my dears who have gone before. It's just been as much a part of me as getting up in the morning like that. So the expectation of gifts from there is just like my mother always had. Mother had a thing. She was as faithful and as inactive as any woman I've ever seen. She had a saying, pray at night and plan in the morning. And this always was what I grew up on. My father's saying was, things work out. And with that kind of expectation of the good, we grew up. But Mother was always working on the weather, she would say, for anything that was coming up. She'd put herself to it and let her faith somehow be a part of everything that was going on. And just like when any of us were flying, and my three brothers and I have had lives that involved a whole lot of flying away, and Mother would always be working on the weather wherever we were and making sure that the plane came in and we got home safely. But it was an extension of that, where she was working on the weather for whatever was happening. And always we expected it to be a wonderfully efficacious kind of working. So as far as believing in that kind of thing, it's been always there. I had an interesting encounter with a very late thinking about Joseph Smith when I was at one of these poetry workshops in Florida. And we'd been... do you want me to tell this much?
Yeah, tell it and read the poem.
Oh, all right. But I'd been in a poetry workshop for 3 weeks with wonderful poets from across the country. We were studying with William Stafford, who's as fine a man as he is poet. He's a remarkable man. He reminds me a lot of Lowell Bunyan, who's been my mentor through all of my days. But he was a pacifist during World War II. He was a conscientious objector. He's a member of the Church of the Brethren, which is very close to Quakers. But it was interesting in this group because he had chosen the poets personally. We'd submitted our work, and he'd chosen us. And he said when we were well into this workshop, and you get to know each other very well when you work and write together for 3 weeks, and he said always at a poetry workshop, you find that you get stimulated emotionally and mentally. But he said it's the first one he'd ever been in where he felt that same kind of stimulation spiritually, which was interesting because everybody had been writing about their own beliefs and their groundings and their faiths. And I'd written more about my church than I had in a long time in a setting like that. I'd written MIA lessons forever when I was on the general board, and I'd written all kinds of things that had church orientation, but I'd never written about my church as such for people who knew nothing about it. The only thing that they had ever heard read, it was interesting, was a Sherlock Holmes piece, or story, called The Scarlet Something. Does anybody remember that? It's a dreadful story. I got it out of the library and read it. What is it, Leonard? The Scarlet Something. But in this, Brigham Young's forces go out and kidnap women and bring them in and hold them hostage, and they're into this valley that they can't escape from, and there are guards on all the mountains, and, oh, it's a fierce kind of thing. But that's about their acquaintance with Mormonism. And so it was interesting for me to be the only Mormon that any of them had ever known, really, and to be writing about this and about my faith. And during the time that I was there, just before I left, there'd been the Hoffman killings, and it was a threat. It was an invasion into my sense of the beauty of life and the tranquility and the benign things that were offered in Salt Lake Valley. And so I went away with that. While I was away, one of my very dear friends died of AIDS, and he was later to leave me his Stations of the Cross paintings. And then when I arrived there, just after I arrived, President Kimball died. And it was strange to have that kind of thing come when I was away, and apart from the people that I could share that kind of grief with, I'd worked with President Kimball and I loved and respected him in so many ways, and it seemed very, very strange, the whole thing. And while I was there, I had a call from Thomas Monson saying that he was in the first presidency. I was really happy that he was going to be. He'd been chairman of the Deseret News Board that I'd served on for now 17 years, and we were good friends. But at any rate, we were walking one night out on the Atlantic beach, these 10 poets of us together, and our assignment for the day had been to write a pantoum, which none of us had ever heard of except one man there. Most of these taught in colleges and had backgrounds of teaching, but only one had ever heard of a pantoum, which is an unusual Malaysian form that uses repetition instead of rhyme. And that was the time when Halley's Comet was to be visible up in the heavens, sort of like the meteors. We were the dancing of the meteors that were going to be here last Wednesday night. Only this was the time when our naturalist, who was among us, said they would be there. So we were out walking on the beach, and we were going to look for the comet. And there were four pairs of binoculars among us. And somebody said, well, these binoculars are stronger than Galileo's telescope was. So we expected, except everybody but me expected. And I didn't think I'd see anything because I've never seen anything through a microscope or a telescope or anything. I'm terrible at it. My children all make fun of the way I take pictures because I can't close one eye, and I'm very strange at it. So I expected to just see all Milky Ways. But I got those binoculars, and I looked up there into the heavens, and they said they would be right by Pleiades. Well, I was lucky even to find Pleiades, the seven sisters, and with lots of instruction. But right there, just right next to Pleiades, through these binoculars, I said, hey, there it is. There's the comet. So they all got their binoculars and tried to look. Nobody could see anything up there but me. So I describe, we'll come down here, and this is going to make a nice little triangle, and right over here you'll find it. And no one saw anything. We traded binoculars. I put my elbows on people's shoulders, on the car doors, everything. And no matter how I'd search the heavens, I'd always come back, and there it was, this darting light. Well, they all kidded me. And we knew each other well enough by then that they'd tell me it was a UFO, or it was, it was all in my imagination. And then finally, when we were walking home, and this was a driving beach like Daytona, it was very hard, and I looked down and saw a shell that I picked up. And it was the naturalist in our group again said this was an angel wing. And she said it's really unusual to find a shell like that that's whole, because they all get ruined as the crush. Cars go by. At any rate, I went home that night and wrote my first pantoum. Series of three, and you'll recognize the form. This is called Meditations on the Heavens. The first one, the comet is an angel wing. Angel wings are on the beach. I found one shining in the sand one late night looking for the comet we'd been told would be near Pleiades. I found one shining in the sand, a nebulous and luminescent cloud, like we'd been told would be near Pleiades, a long, curved vapor tail by the moon's first lifted lid, a nebulous and luminescent cloud, now striated, fragile, rippled bone of wave, tide, wind, a long, curved vapor tail by the moon's first lifted lid, the shell as smooth and rough as what we walk, striated, fragile, rippled bone of wave, tide, wind, an ancient icon, like the comet's head approaching sun, the shell as smooth and rough as what we walk, a celestial body grounded for our view, an ancient icon like a comet's head approaching sun, an angel wing is on the beach, a celestial body grounded for our view, one late night looking for the comet. So I went to bed, and naturally I woke up with a different idea. And this is the second one. The comet is a darting light. Suppose he really saw the vision, God, the angel. My church owns the story, Joseph in the Grove, 14, a supernatural sight of extraordinary beauty and significance while praying for a truth that had eluded others. My church owns the story, Joseph in the Grove, 14, not unlike Joan, young Buddha, or Muhammad, while praying for a truth that had eluded others. From unusual encounter, the gift more than surprising. Not unlike with Joan, young Buddha, or Muhammad, it had to be believed, the unbelievable. In unusual encounter, the gift more than surprising. Looking through binoculars the night I found the comet, it had to be believed, the unbelievable. The meteor, the incandescent sparkler writing names by Pleiades. Coming through binoculars the night I found the comet, more than white on black, that no one else could see. The meteor, the incandescent sparkler writing names by Pleiades. Suppose he really saw the vision, God, the angel, more than white on black that no one else could see, a supernatural sight of extraordinary beauty and significance. It was really an interesting kind of supposing among those friends. Now, then I was away in Sun Valley 5 months later. Nine months later. And I woke up again with a notion that, of course, that's what I'd see. Of course, that's what the eventualities would be from one meditation to another. And this is called the comet is remembering. Not until today, this small comet in my scalp, the clamoring of memory, the painting, in the chapel of my childhood against the organ loft, Joseph kneeling at the elevated feet of the Father and the Son. The clattering of memory, the painting, backdrop to the hymns, the bishop, and the sacrament. Joseph kneeling at the elevated feet of the Father and the Son. Did the artist put it in, the vision, or did I? Backdrop to the hymns, the bishop, and the sacrament. My quarter century there, it rose indigenous as music. Did the artist put it in, the vision, or did I? In the sacred grove, sun streaming on the boy at prayer. My quarter century there, it rose indigenous as music. More real now than Palmyra, where I occupied one grown-up Sunday, the sacred grove. Sun streaming on the boy at prayer, indelible, unknowing, like features of a mother giving milk. More real now than the sacred grove, I occupied one grown-up Sunday. Not until today, this small comet in my scalp, indelible unknowing, like the features of a mother giving milk, in the chapel of my childhood, against the organ loft, the vision. And that was interesting in that September, and then or October, and then that very month, Mel and I went to a missionary farewell, back in the old Highland Park ward where I'd grown up and spent those 25 first years of my life. And there was the painting, the same painting by Lee Green Richards. Beautiful, beautiful painting. I looked at that through the entire the whole service, and there was no boy at prayer. There was no vision. Only the sacred grove. Only the trees and the sun streaming through. And I sat there thinking, did the artist put it in, the vision, or did I?
Let's have a little change of pace and move to the third topic in our triad, a woman's place. Some would say that this hasn't been exactly a banner year for women in the Mormon Church. How do you feel about being a Mormon woman? Do you feel oppressed at all in any way? And what are your feelings about that?
Of course I ache for the things that are happening for women in many places in the church. Of course I yearn and try to say that there need to be differences, that it would be wonderful if we could be having a say. I guess that's the thing that I've longed for more than anything, is to have a real say and to feel as though we did. My experience has been different from other people's. And I feel as though the thing that I need to do is to stay somehow in harmony with the people that I see who can make a difference. Not that I don't want to object to things that I see as inequities very often. But I also feel that the best way that we can make a difference, and I've learned this from my mentor Lowell Bunyan, is to stay within the fold and operate from there and do what we can. Each of us in our different ways, each of us has such a different possibility of saying and doing and making those differences. I heartily support people in the different ways that they go about trying to make differences. I think it's so important that we recognize each other's experience and that we give credence to each other's experience, because mine has been different from yours or from somebody else's does not make yours less important or less credible. But all I have to give, I think, is my own experience, what I have to deal with, so that I can say, for me, this is true. And it's like my belief in whatever we've been talking about. I can say this is true. Sometimes I do not like to go out seeming to represent what I really don't represent. I never talk about anything that I don't genuinely believe in. And I think wherever I am, I get to say the things that I do care about. So that if I'm appearing today at a Sunstone symposium, it's because I think that Sunstone can, and its other publications like Dialogue and Exponent. I've written a column for Exponent for 10 years, side by side with Laurel Ulrich. And we've been able to say the things we think and care about in the hope that other people will identify with it, and that we can legitimize people wherever they are on the spectrum. It's no secret that I appear on Sunstone Symposia. I have for many years in different... But I have a feeling that the things that happen where people talk about how they feel and talk about what they see as true, that this holds people in the church rather than drives them out. I think it gives people a forum for being able to talk about some of their beliefs and their doubts, their questions. Questing to me is a very, not only credible, but very important thing for all of us. And if questing involves wondering, I think wonder is the first step to learning very much of anything. We need to keep our curiosity alive. Curiosity about people, curiosity about the divine, curiosity about what we're believing. All the way along, it's a journey. It is not an arrival. This does not mean that I can't have respect and give credence to those men that I get to deal with in the heart of the church who offer us different kinds of goodness. We all make mistakes. We're all human. We're all subject to the kinds of things that we'll say, this is my way of doing, and it may not be yours in any way, shape, or fashion. But I think the only thing that I really can do is to be my own lightning rod, where if I feel grounded and my faith feels secure, I doesn't mean that I deny that the storms are there or that I would love to be able to do something to ameliorate the pain that comes through many storms that are out there right now. But it doesn't mean that I have to give up my own faith. If I can retain the kingdom of God that is within me, which is to me the ultimate, and keep my grounding, then I can manage in the storms. This is not to say that this cannot be different one day from one day to another. Is this the sort of thing that you wanted to talk about?
Sure. If it's what you want to talk about. some people might look at you and think that you've lived a charmed life, Emmalou. And yet, like anyone else, you've had a lot of problems to face and a lot of hard things to overcome. One experience that you have had, you've written about in a book recently with your daughter, Becky Thane Markosian, Hope and Recovery. Could you talk a little bit about the book and what it's meant to you and to other people to have you write this book with Becky?
I think that this is one of the things that I'm talking about in terms of the lightning rod kind of image. When she was 19, our oldest girl, Becky, who's back here today, had a very serious episode of manic depression and then bulimia and anorexia in a time in 1970 when nobody knew anything about these diseases, least of all us. Here was our oldest daughter, and we... fumbling, bumbling parents wanting to do the right things and not having the slightest idea what was right. Had 3 years of, 3.5 years of real struggle where she was, could have been, well, she was suicidal. She was into things that were so destructive to her that it was, we had a time that was the bleakest I think we've ever had. When Becky came to me or called me about 3 years ago now and said she wanted to tell her story because she'd been able to help some girls out in her ward where she was working with young women. And she said that when she helped the girls, she found that the girls had as much, or the mothers had as much pain and trouble as the girls who were involved. And so she wanted us to tell the story together, which we did. And I was really pleased that she wanted to do this because it took a lot of courage. She'd felt for all these years that she was kind of the black sheep of the family while all four of her sisters were going along just royally doing the things that seemed to make sense and do well in the world that we all lived in. So I was really pleased. And what a time we had. It was catharsis It was 1 minute crying and the next minute laughing. She came to my studio every Thursday. We have lunch, all of my daughters and I, when they're in town. And on Thursday, and then Becky would come to the studio and we'd write. She was a little intimidated by writing. She's a stained glass artist and does wonderful things with her hands, but had never done any really formal writing, although she's the grammarian and the speller of the family. But she could talk and I could write in as fast as she could talk on that blessed computer. So it kept her style, and then I'd write my part of the story. So that's the format. And we told all about these 3 years and what happened. And the book has been a remarkable kind of offering, I think, in that, like in a Deseret News article that was in the paper last fall, where they were writing about it. The quote at the end of this I've liked because I think it's what's happened. It's been well reviewed. It's now into a second printing in New York. And what Susan Lyman Whitney has to say about this. Gradually she got better. But what advice does she have for single women? She now has 3 sons, young sons of her own, and is married and has recently gone into real estate and has a good life. There must be other ways to recover. Markosian agrees. She thinks high school athletics give girls the exercise they need to handle stress, as well as a way to achieve that has nothing to do with boys. Is there a way, wonders Thane, that's me, to impart a sense of wonder about what the body can do? When they talk to audiences, they talk about accepting yourself the way you are, but their main message is that Becky could not have gotten better by herself. She needed the help of professionals. Now that her sons are growing up and she's established a reputation as a stained glass artist and she's joined her husband in the real estate business, just now, when she's 40 and capable, and glad to be 40 and capable, Markosian is willing to risk something she never would have been able to risk before. She's willing to risk having a less-than-perfect image now so that she can tell other less-than-perfect people that they aren't alone. And I think that's what the... the book has been about.
Why don't we, are you ready for some questions from the audience? I've given you all the softballs now. Maybe they'll throw up some hardballs for you. If you would like to ask questions, please do so, and I will repeat all the questions into the microphone because this session, as all sessions of the Sunstone Symposium, is being recorded. Any questions? Okay, the question concerns the changes in some of the women's organizations in the church and jurisdictional changes which took the control of the organizations from women to men. I think, is that a fair summary?
I think this is a very obviously a clear observation. Maybe one of the best ways I can tell you about the changes is to refer you to historians, women historians, who've done a marvelous job of putting Relief Society history together. Maureen Beecher and Jill Mulvey-Durr have done this, and it is a remarkably candid history of the Relief Society. And I would recommend this book to anybody. What's the exact name of the book? Women of the Covenant.
And Janet Cannon was the other author.
Oh, and Janet Cannon. Yeah. And she was in the Relief Society presidency. Let me tell you a little about my personal experience with this kind of thing. I served on the general board of the Relief Society, or of the MIA, when, frankly, it was Camelot times. It was when Florence Jacobson was the president, and we didn't live in a memo world. We did things as they occurred. When we had an idea, we'd go to Florence, and if she liked the idea, it would sail. I think things changed when correlation came into being. And everybody, the idea was that everything would be correlated and would be run under the aegis of the priesthood. How that occurred and why, I don't have the slightest idea. I feel the same way, that it would be a wonderful thing to have women, as I said, have a say and be responsible for their own organizations and their own lives and their own lessons and all of those things. And I've been saying this in many places for a long time. I think there are many people that feel this way. And as near as I can tell, and I say this very hopefully, I know that there are bad things, I mean things that seem to be not so hopeful for women and their autonomy in any sense. But I have in the last while seen some indications that there are some ideas going around that will say that women should be the ones in the Relief Society lessons, that women should be the ones who determine their fate and what they're to do. I've seen indications that there will be better listening provided for people with new ideas and how to use them. It would be very easy to be discouraged and to see this gradual draining away of any kind of self-propulsion that might be there for women. And again, I think that it's very important that we express ourselves and write to the people who can make a difference. Talk to them. Say the things that are important and not sit quietly by just murmuring. To me, that's the least productive thing that ever can happen. But I think that it will pay off, like writing to a senator, to voice the ways that we feel. Because every letter means something. And whatever we're saying is going to be heard better if more of us are saying it, and if we're willing to be saying what we're saying. This does not have to mean that we're somehow walking away from the church, or that we're denying the realities of what we believe. It doesn't mean that. I'm just more and more convinced that some we can, with a notion of thinking, let's work together on things. And let's let it... I heard Chieko Kosaka talk Sunday night at a fireside in our stake. She was wonderful, and she had a remarkable kind of metaphor that I think really, really works. She started out quoting Laurel Ulrich, which I liked a lot. She said that Laurel is dealing in fabrics now. But Chieko held up a checkered tablecloth, a red checkered tablecloth. And, of course, all of us have had a tablecloth like this at some time in our homes. But she said, look at this. It looks as though there are three colors, but there are only two. It all depends on how the weaving takes place. The pure white, she said, suppose the pure white are the women and the red are the men, and there are squares that have to operate separately. But there are a lot of areas where the two are woven together, and it becomes a different shade entirely than either the white or the red. It's a different color. And she said, I guess what we're about, and I really like this, she said, I think what we're about is to try to extend those areas of the working together, where there's one thread of this and one thread of that. And there's a wonderful kind of equality in how that weaving goes and what comes out of it. And I think that's exactly how I feel about it. How I can't account. What's your name? Well, it's nice to see you again, Francis. It's been a year or two. But I can't account for all this except that this was, I think, a product of correlation, where there was this effort to have everything under one umbrella, and therefore it meant that the autonomy was drained off. I haven't any answers as to what can happen here except that I can attest to the fact that there is great thought being put onto this, and it is not being ignored. Let me just say that. I'm absolutely positive about this. And so there are some moves being made right now as to what's going to happen with women and meetings and things like that. And the main thing that I keep thinking we can do, and I was back at an exponent retreat a month ago, and it was a remarkable time. And there was a feeling there, rather than just of indignation, which could be there for the way some of the problems that women have faced, but over and above and beyond that, there was something that was a sense of a general movement toward finding ways together that will produce a kind of harmony, that we will get the things we want. And one of the women there, Jolene, I don't remember her last name.
Rockwood?
No, it wasn't Jolene Rockwood. Who was it, Nancy? Anyhow, she proposed in a wonderful workshop that we circle the last day of the month, and that on that day we all have a common sense of meditation and prayer for all of the oppressed women in the world, from Somalia to the feelings of anybody in Mormondom. Did you think of the name? Anyhow, it was a wonderful idea, and then that was expanded to thinking, you know, we can't make a lot of difference in a lot of ways, but we can by exerting our mutual and common prayers for a given kind of end. I got to be part of prayer and meditation. It was called the Peace Celebration up at the university in Kingsbury Hall on New Year's Eve Day in 1986. And we'd planned this. Ardeen Watts, I saw, leave, and he and I were part of the planning. And we'd planned this so that 16 different faiths came together on this program. No one was introduced. Music was planned that would accompany the people who were talking from these different traditions. And we invited people, and 200 million people around the world assembled in different places to pray in their own ways or meditate for peace. And by the time that we had no idea how many would come, but there came into that an overflow crowd. And there were quiet times, which are sometimes a little difficult for Mormons. We're used to having something going on all the time and get a little restless if a meditation were to go very long. It started with 1 minute. We ended with 3 minutes. And within this hour, I was sitting on the stand between a general authority of the
Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and a Navajo, both of whom had gone to that pulpit or podium and had said something in their own faith, in their own words, in their own language. A young boy talked in Swahili and read from the Bible what he felt about peace. At any rate, I was standing there, sitting there. We stood up and joined hands at the end of this marvelous meeting. And there was a palpable there, this sense of belonging to each other and being connected somewhere that was being tuned in. And we stood up and we stood and sang, "Let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me." And I remember holding the hands of those two men and feeling that warmth and that certainty that we were being heard. Well, look what happened after that in 1986. The next year was when Gorbachev and Reagan got together for the first time before long. Now, it happened. I have every conviction that that's how things happen. And that if we can combine our faith to pray for things that we see as being really beneficial to people, and in the interest of people who are hurting, and in the interest of people who can make a difference, and there are people who can, and this I know is how it's going to happen, by hearing that kind of thing, sensing it, responding to it. And I have every conviction that that will happen. Yes. That's it. Why don't you?
Go ahead. You.
The question is whether Emmalou has felt some sadness and unease about the church not being able to utilize Brother Lowell Bunyan better.
I'm really glad you asked that question. It's very timely. I've been reading the biography of Lowell Bunyan. I've reread all of his works in this last year, and I realize why I go through everything he writes nodding and saying yes, yes, yes. He really is an inspired man as far as I'm concerned. He has an interesting saying that says, and I've thought about this a lot lately, "To action alone hast thou a right, not to its fruits." And I think he's lived by that. So that he's not been a bitter man regardless of what's happened to him. But in tracing his life, which started out in this community as head of the Institute of Religion at the University of Utah for 28 years there, then he was let go when he really never knew why. But he moved to the University of Utah as an associate dean of students, where speaking of having an epiphany as I was reading this, and I got to the part where I'd always felt really unhappy that that had happened for Lowell. And I thought, here's this man of God that I'm convinced is, who was so little utilized by the church. And yet, look what happened to him. He went from there where he was maybe influencing 300 to 400 students a year at the university. I was one of them. And then he moved out to the university itself from the institute, and began influencing students of every faith, every color, creed, dimension, and broadened his influence. And oh my, did he broaden it at the university. And then when it was almost time for him to retire, he took on the directorship of the Community Services Council. And imagine what happened to his influence at that point. It just took off until there's hardly anybody in this valley that you don't say Lowell. And they know that that's Lowell Bunyan, who's been responsible for more humanitarian good works than anyone in this valley can ever think of. He's been honored everywhere, nationally as well. And I think, my morning meditations that's one of the things that came in one of those times when I was thinking about that, because I was concerned with his life at that time. But I think I grow more and more convinced that we, as the wonderful Alcoholics Anonymous Creed, the serenity prayer that says, "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference."
And I think each of us has to take on change with whatever courage we have, with whatever we can do ourselves, and with the notion that we let go and let God, which is another of their creeds, and that the corners will be there to be turned. It isn't to say we sit by and accept and say, it's okay, all is well. But I do believe very sincerely that there are routes that will take their course, and that somehow it's going to be different for people who need to have it be different.
Lori?
Question concerns the experiences of during 17 years as the only woman on the member of the Deseret News board.
Oh, yes, I've had interesting experiences, I should say. I've liked very much being in touch with a newspaper, the cutting edge of everything. You really get acquainted with what's going on in the world. And I've had such respect for the people who do that every day. You know, put out a paper every day, write, edit, paginate, get it out on the porches. It's a miracle to me. I've had a lot of experiences where I have felt that my position there, token as I probably am, still that my position is to be an advocate for the people who don't have a voice somewhere else. And I've felt very lucky to have that voice and to have a forum where I can go in and talk or call on the phone or talk to people who can make a difference. And I've been able to express my feelings, and they've always been candid. I haven't been, I haven't had to hold back. I've said what I feel. And they've accepted that, not always. I mean, sometimes it's with, I'm sure, a kind of, well, there's Emmalou at it again. But I also feel as though I get to be heard, and I get to listen to them. And that there's been some sharing, and it isn't as if I've always come away thinking, whoopee, we're going to do something that I think makes sense. But at the same time, I continue to feel as though a newspaper can be a vehicle for such good if we allow it to be. And it also is something that is just up for grabs left and right. You know, everybody's reading it, everybody's saying what's going on, and then there's always the very valid accusation that it's an organ of the church. And it's hard for a paper that's an organ of the church to be a metropolitan newspaper. Very difficult kind of thing. And how that ever could be changed, I cannot imagine. So if the church news carries less than hard news, it's because it is the vehicle of the church. And it needs to carry the news that carries the church in the ways that it wants to be carried. So did you have other questions about that? Laurie?
Oh.
Well, Emmalou, we've almost reached the end of our allotted time, and I can think of no more fitting way to close our session today than to have you just read one more of your poems, if you'd select one that you think we'd especially enjoy. Thank you.
I don't mean to sound as though I never get angry, because I do. I get angry, and I get upset, and I get all of the other kinds of things. And I turn always to... It sometimes is easier to write angry poems than it is not-so-angry poems. But I seem to come out of them, and my books are full of the angry ones as well as the others. But This I maybe would be interesting. This was in Sunstone not very long ago. In fact, they published it twice. I don't know why. I think it was just a mistake. But this is called Psalm, and it's from out air, where I would rather be than anywhere in this world, where we have our cabin, and where this morning I got to get up and pat and pamper and hose down the dust and get rid of the problems in every corner of that place for a party that's going to be up there tonight. And this one morning I sat out on the deck, and our Sunday school teacher in our Monument Park Third Ward, which I love, we've lived there for 37 years now, and what a place to live. And we've watched people grow old with doing good, and wonderful young people move in. This is where I go to see the church at work and to recognize why I go to church every Sunday, most Sundays. I love it. I love the people. I love what happens there. Sometimes it's boring. Sometimes it's great. It's everything that living is. But on this one morning, the man who was teaching our Sunday school class had asked me if I would help him teach the Psalms. So I got up and went out on the deck underneath the green, wonderful green mountain that we live under, and read all the Psalms through. And then I wrote this psalm, and it just happened that this was the Sunday before my accident. And this is how I was feeling on that day. And I felt just like this morning. From out air. I awake to the songs of birds. The sounds of thy creatures awakeneth me. Thy skies are the blue of thy deepest waters. Deep and broad are they in their invitation to my soul to soar. In mine eyes are thy words, in my heart the songs of rejoicing in thee. Blessed, O God, be the quiverings of life in the branches of trees, in my limbs, and holy be the sun on the leaves and needles and on the hair of my head and the feeling beneath it. I bow to the joy of thy bounty. I raise up my voice to sing praises for the grace of thy hand in all the world. Here in the thickets of thy kindness, and the beauty of thy hand, thou makest me still to know thou art indeed God. Thank you.